All right, started.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. It's the February 2024 Pulmonary Pathology Journal Club, and we'll start off with Dr. Moore, who's our fellow who's rotating currently in Rochester, but we're delighted to have her. Sam, do you want to share your screen?
I will. Let's see. Here we go. First, I'll share the article. Can everybody see the article? This article is by the MD Anderson and UT Houston groups in the pathologic processing of lung cancer resection specimens after neoadjuvant therapy. So, in essence, we're dealing with how to deal with a tumor bed and how to assess the residual viable tumor and other aspects of that tumor bed. So, what I'd like to do here, though, is give a brief PowerPoint, if I may, so that because I think that doing this in pictures rather than just in words could be helpful. So I'm going to switch quickly, if I may. Okay. Can everybody see a blob?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. So the idea is this. This is the specimen, and here's the tumor bed. So if one does a standard sampling of the tumor bed, one section per centimeter, one ends up with a few slides, and that's not too bad. And if it's a reasonably sized tumor bed, if you do the gold standard, which is to submit the entire thing, it's still not too much of a headache. But then comes the specimen like this, where the tumor bed is enormous, and doing one section per centimeter is a small headache, but then sampling the entire tumor, you would need a small army to look at all these slides. And this is neither fruitful, in terms of time, in terms of cost, in terms of all kinds of overhead. So this group was asking the question, how many sections do we actually need in order to be accurate? Is there a happy medium between the gold standard and the one section per centimeter, or are we just fine with the one section per centimeter? So in order to do this, we use the help of computers, and I think this was where it's got really clever. So they took 31 tumors, submitted them entirely, did the gold standard treatment, and then determined residual viable tumor, as well as, from that falls out whether there's major pathologic response, less than 10% of tumor volume, or a complete pathologic response, zero tumor remaining. So what they did was, from a tumor bed submitted entirely, they picked out a subset of, the number X, however many you want to pick, and calculate the RVT, and then with a computer, pick out another subset. And then another subset, and calculate this 1,000 times. And then you take these numbers and compare to the gold standard residual viable tumor result. So you're comparing these subsets to what you would get if you assessed an entire submission of the tumor bed. And then you would pick a bigger subset, or a smaller one, or a differently sized one, and then another combination of that same number of slides again and again, iteratively do that 1,000 times. And so you can see where computers are very useful in this because we can come up with good numbers. So for the results of each subset, you'll compare that residual tumor volume determined to the gold standard to see how many sections we really need to get. And they sort of pulled this number out of a hat, 90% accuracy, where that's defined as being within plus or minus 5% of the gold standard determination of residual viable tumor. So that's basically what they did, and I hope the pictures kind of helped to make that clear. What they found was it takes 21 slides. If you've got a tumor that for which the full submission would be greater than 21 slides, you need 21, more or less. And so to simplify, they say 20. So 20 slides is sort of their algorithm. Now, I'd like to go back to the article. There was another really neat finding that they had, which I'd like to highlight to you. Which was not only do they find that you need 20 slides for a very large tumor, and their largest tumor, I believe, took 186 slides to submit entirely, but it matters the chance that a calculation is going to be accurate depends on how much residual viable tumor there is. So if it looks here as from this graph, you see nicely that if you have between 0 and 10% residual viable tumor, then your standard deviation of the readings is pretty low. And if you've got a whole lot of residual viable tumor, 80 to 100%, then your standard deviation is pretty low. So your accuracy is going to be pretty good. But where you can get into trouble is in these intermediate areas where your RVT is between 10 and 80%. And that's something that I wouldn't have expected. And I thought that was pretty interesting. But overall, they came up with a determination that about 20 slides is the number that we need for sufficient accuracy. And they referenced three interesting articles. And I put the summary slide at the end. So they referenced Cottrell et al. In 2018, and to answer the question of how many slides do we need, these guys recommended one cross-section per centimeter plus a cross-section of the greatest area, submit that entirely. And then Dr. Travis in 2020 with the IASLC recommendation said, okay, guys, do one section per centimeter plus a cross-section of the most representative section of viable tumor as seen grossly, submit that entirely. Sort of reminiscent of what we do for Ewing sarcoma. You know, you've got residual tumor and you take a cross-section and you submit that entirely. And then there was a publication in I believe that was 2022, there's a typo there, by Saki et al., and this involved Drs. Coley and Leslie, where they said, go ahead for tumors under 3 centimeters, submit those entirely. For anything that could possibly be complete pathologic response, submit that entirely just so you don't miss something, and then for all else, submit 50%. And now we have a fourth recommendation with this paper for all tumor beds that for which full submission would require fewer than or equal to 20 sections, submit that entirely, but greater than 20 sections, submit 20 sections at least in order to evaluate. So I thought these recommendations were really interesting. And again, this was done with an unweighted assessment of tumor, like the tumor area was not taken into consideration. You just, for each slide, you get a percent of residual viable tumor, and you average those per slide. It doesn't matter if you have this much tumor on a slide or that much tumor on a slide. It's the same number per slide. And people do a little bit more complicated work with that as far as, normalizing per unit area and so forth. So I'm wondering, what do you do? What do you think of these recommendations? Do you think there's merit in considering cases of potential complete pathologic response? Where am I really going to say zero if I don't look at all the slides? If I don't look at all the entire tumor bed? What do you think of the one section per centimeter, which is standard practice in some places? And what do you think of doing it numerically as these folks did? Interested to hear your impressions.
Go ahead. I can start. So I guess my question is, does it result in a meaningful change in T stage when you add all the, put in all of these more sections? Because to me, I don't know about where you are, but at least our lab's pretty strained. And so putting in 20 sections sounds like a lot of sections if it's not going to lead to something meaningful clinically. You know, was this between a, or did they not navigate that at all? Because it seems to me that the accuracy was just based on comparing all the tumor versus how many can we get the closeness to that. But did they say, does this actually result in a change in T stage?
I didn't see that in here. I think this was more of a, yeah, I believe this was more of taking it from the grossing bench and to the slides, and I don't think it was carried over into the natural consequence of this determination, which is how does it affect T stage? How does it affect they referenced the percent RVT being correlated with outcomes, and I think that's as far as that I saw them go. But that would be an interesting study.
You know, I guess in any sampling of the growth specimen, the considering the growth appearance, in a way, the Travis's recommendation, looking at each slice and see the most viable tumor is present should be submitted, to look at. So instead of doing like a robotic work, We just have to use our, judgment based on growth also, that can save a lot of, blocks and work.
Hi there. Sorry, I missed the beginning. I was a bit late, but I just wanted to ask. So, this is so that we can pick up all the high-grade areas in the tumor, in cases that are not that haven't actually been treated with chemo beforehand, I guess. And does that make any difference to how the patients are treated by the oncologists?
I believe these were all done on patients who had received neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
Okay. Yeah. So sorry, I thought you were saying in cases that had not had chemotherapy, that last recommendation, but that is for cases that had chemotherapy beforehand.
Yes,
Oh,
it
I
is.
see. So not saying 20 sections for every single tumor.
Oh, correct, correct. Yes,
Okay. Got it.
the leading premise was that we're dealing only with cases of neoadjuvant where it's assessment of a tumor bed. Assessment
Okay.
of a tumor bed is the
Yeah,
goal.
I agree that we need to do this. I know it's a lot of extra work, but I think it's something that needs to be done because it will be relevant to prognosis.
Well, I think that's what Christine was asking. I think we don't know that. So what would be good is if somebody looked at did what all three of these studies have done to the same set of cases and then compare them to stage and follow up, which none of these have done. If they were only looking at the pathology end of the equation here, not the clinical end of the equation.
I think
But
the
there are
other
some ways
aspect
to do it. Sorry.
What seems to be missing is the 10% cutoff that we currently have for a major pathologic response. I don't think they looked into that. They looked into complete pathologic response, but nature. What I would be curious is what is everyone doing in a tumor that, let's say, is 5 centimeters? You submit a couple of sections, none of them shows viable tumor. Do you go back and submit the entire tumor to make sure there is no viable tumor in there, or what do you currently do?
I feel like I would do that anecdotally on my case, but in general, at least here in Arizona, we're not getting that many of these cases, these post-treatment cases. But it seems reasonable to do that.
Are
I don't
people
recall
getting a
that I've
lot of
done
these
it.
cases?
No, I think that was, we're not in Arizona.
We're not either.
We're getting some, but I have to admit I don't recall what I've done, mostly because there is some viable tumor. So
Yeah.
I guess it would be a question if it came up.
Right. I mean,
So whatever it's worth, sorry, I had to present to our frozen section group to recommend what to do. Because we don't have a whole lot, but we're getting more and more. I mean, we can clearly see the increasing tendency these days. So actually, with our consensus in our group, I gave the recommendation of Travis's, IASLC recommendation. So whatever it's worth, that's what I recommend. I mean, on behalf of our group, I recommend it to the frozen section group.
I also could imagine that we will see more and more of these because of these kind of recommendations or trials that they have neoadjuvant immunotherapy, plus minus chemotherapy in even low stage, clinically low stage tumors. So I think it's coming if it's not there yet. So we have to have a good approach or consistent approach, maybe.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I agree. I also worry that if I don't take the whole tumor bed, they're going to find, well, it was important prognostically in the future. So those studies would be really useful to be done in the meantime.
I mean, this sort of I sort of like the it's a little similar to getting a TURP, right? You put in so many specimens from a prostate TURP, and then up to a certain percentage, you don't gain anything more by putting more in. So, I mean, I do like that approach, but I think again, they have to, it'd be nice to know what the clinical implications and the staging are and whether anybody does anything with that. I mean, I don't really know what anybody's doing with residual tumor. Is it prognostic Or is it only prognostic, or is it therapeutic? Are they making therapeutic decisions on what to do? And I don't know the answer to that. Somebody probably does, but I don't. All right. Well, why don't we move on? Thank you, Dr. Moore. That was great. And you're setting a high bar for, presenting at Journal Club. And I can just tell you that I won't be preparing PowerPoints mostly.
Thank you.
So let me pull up my stuff here. So the next article we're going to look at is on micropapillary and solid components. I'll just take a step back and say there weren't very many articles I found kind of worthy of discussion. So I was kind of, that's just me probably, but, so take these as, the best of the articles, in my opinion. So this was on micropapillary and solid components, and they were trying to figure out whether the 20% cutoff that is present in the proposed grading system is the right cutoff. So this was 648 consecutive patients who underwent complete resections and were examined for clinopathologic, genotypic, and immunophenotypic features, as well as treatment outcomes. And they looked at the clinical impact of different high-grade components, specifically micropapillary and solid, and they individually evaluated them. For typical, they deleted a lot of, it did not use a lot of patients with other cancers, CIS, mucinous adenocarcinoma, non-curative resections, and et cetera. Onto the results, the survival outcomes were well stratified according to the proposed grading system, the one that we're probably all using. Not surprisingly, grade three tumors exhibited aggressive clinical pathologic features, including visceral pleural invasion, LVI, and lymph node mets. The five-year overall survival rates were significantly worse for those with low and intermediate grade tumors compared to high-grade tumors. So again, not surprising. So here's the sort of the meat of their results. The authors then analyzed the grade three micropapillary and the grade three solid containing greater than 20% without any of the other high-grade components. So they were trying to isolate the significance of the solid and micropapillary components. Overall survival and relapse-free survival in patients with grade three micropapillary and grade three solid tumors did significantly worse than those with grade one and two tumors. Again, not terribly surprising. Although relapse-free survival with grade three micropapillary tumors was significantly worse than grade three solid tumors, but the overall survival did not differ significantly. They then examined the prognostic impact of smaller proportions of the high-grade tumor. So, prognosis of patients with grade two tumors with less than 20% micropapillary was significantly worse than tumors lacking micropapillary components. And the same was true for small proportions of solid tumors. There was a survival advantage for adjuvant chemotherapy in patients with high-grade adenocarcinoma. Again, maybe not completely surprising. Those are the tumors that higher grade, more mitotic activity, they're more likely to respond to chemo. EGFR mutations were frequently identified in low and moderate grade tumors, as well as grade three micropapillary tumors compared to grade three solid tumors. Solid tumors were more commonly associated with ALK, BRAF, mutations rather than KRAS, and they also had higher PD-L1 expressions. So, in summary, I think the authors appear to validate the usefulness of the current system. They also show that micropapillary and solid patterns independently have negative impact in multivariate analysis consistent with prior studies. The negative impact remains even in small proportions of those higher grade components. And the differences in survival between the micropapillary and solid pattern suggests that maybe further sub stratification might be necessary. And then they do comment, I have to give them credit for commenting on the fact that, you know, when you're looking at 5% micropapillary or solid, that judgment is a bit of a challenge. So I thought overall this was a reasonable study. And like I said, I appreciated their comment that it's not always easy to tell, you know, what's 5% micropapillary. Is it one papillae? You know, that's less than 5%. Does that count? So any questions, comments?
I guess there is another component for high-grade pattern. There's a complex glandular like cribriform. So they didn't put
No,
that
they
in
were they were just focused on micropapillary and solid.
solid. But solid didn't include cribriform, I guess.
I don't think so. I don't think they mentioned the hot, you know, the complex cribriform for, you know, complex cribriform or, you know, single cell sort of invasion.
It's unfortunate that that's not listed as a separate pattern to report because I think it gets lost because it's still technically part of Acinar, but then it's a high grade pattern. I think it's just unfortunate. It's kind of confusing for people.
Yeah, it is. So,
And
you know,
again, so sorry.
no, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, this is probably dependent on where you work, but do the oncologists do anything different based on if it's called a grade two with 20% of papillary, micropapillary, would they treat these patients any differently?
In Michigan, they don't care at all what the pattern is. Unless they recur, and then they're like, oh, there was micropapillary.
Yeah.
I think
So.
that's similar to ours. I mean, I don't think it's like with mesotheliomas. Nobody really asks about the grade, right? They're doing their, I think most of their studies are based on stage, not grade. Till there's sort of a combined way of looking at stage and grade together, I think we're giving them information, and maybe it's prognos maybe they talk to the patients about the prognosis, but I'm not aware that treatment changes. All right, I'll move on. I thought this next paper was just worth knowing about because, you know, we all talk about ARDS and we all talk about diffuse alveolar damage. So the last time there was a definition to ARDS was in 2012, and those are called the Berlin criteria. I guess that meeting was in Berlin. So a number of things have changed in the last 10 years, and that was actually sort of interesting to read about. One was the use of pulse oximetry for evaluating oxygenation as opposed to just a blood gas. The use of high flow nasal oxygen to manage severe hypoxemic respiratory failure. And then, you know, I think as we're finding in many areas of medicine, the criteria that we set up in the West and the developed countries doesn't work in low resource settings. And then finally, ultrasound imaging, and I didn't know this either, has been increasingly used in critically ill patients, often supplanting traditional chest radiography to find out what's going on in the chest. So I would ask for a show of hands, but to see how many people knew that ultrasound had sort of moved into the ICU in that way. So I thought that was interesting. So this was sort of the typical committee agreement on, you know, updating a definition. They each work group proposed revisions and through a consensus process, Dr. Myers isn't on. That's too bad. New criteria were established. And then they also asked for input from numerous societies. So the definition, which is shown in table one, and I'm not going to bring that up, but I've written it out here and I'll just read it. ARDS is an acute diffuse inflammatory lung injury precipitated. So here's a key thing that I want to talk about, precipitated by a predisposing risk factor such as pneumonia, infection, trauma, burn, aspiration, or shock. The resulting injury leads to increased pulmonary vascular and epithelial permeability. lung edema, and gravity-dependent atelectasis, all of which contribute to the loss of aerated lung tissue. This is a long definition. Clinical hallmarks are hypoxemia, diffuse radiographic opacities, increased shunting, increased alveolar dead space, and decreased compliance. The clinical presentation is influenced by a lot of things that you can read there. Histologic findings may vary, and I think we all know this. It could be just edema, inflammation, hyaline membrane formation, or alveolar hemorrhage. So again, if you want to go to the paper, the table one expands on the global definition with specific criteria for all the cutoffs. Table two summarizes key differences between the new definition and the old one. ARDS can also be diagnosed in the presence of chronic lung disease, including COPD, ILD, and pulmonary hypertension. Not surprisingly, and I had every intention to going back and looking at supplement D2, as you can see by my highlighted note, but that did not happen. So you can take a look at the supplemental material if you want. So the global criteria are expected to be the basis of future studies. Limitations include the lack of strident methodology for reviewing the literature. This was a little bit loosey-goosey in that regard. And it was mainly based on consensus opinion with dialogue with the major societies. There was no formal prospective testing of the predicted validity of the various parameters. I think what, and I reached out to two of our pulmonologists, so Jay Rue and one locally here, Dr. Anna Zamora, and said, so where do patients with acute interstitial pneumonia fit? Now, I think they do address acute exacerbation as I read, you know, the fact that you could have an underlying ILD. But if it's idiopathic, which is kind of what the definition of acute exacerbation is, this definition does not allow for idiopathic ARDS, which I thought was rather interesting. So, of course, those patients end up on a respirator. So patients with AIP, right? Idiopathic DAD, they don't fit in here. I don't know what happens to those patients. I thought about, you know, going to the website and asking that question, and maybe I still will, because Jay said, yeah, you're absolutely right. I hadn't sort of thought about that. But if you read the paper, it says ARDS is only is caused by those, only you can only, def, it, it's only meets criteria for ARDS if you have an underlying etiology. So I don't know. I think somebody was asleep at the wheel, but what can I say? Anyway, you might want to take a look at that paper. You might hear them talk about the new criteria. And I don't know what this is going to be labeled. I guess maybe just global ARDS definition without a city, since it's meant to be relevant for low resource settings. Perhaps they've adopted, you know, this global terminology. Any questions, comments? All right. Well, if anybody looks at the paper and sees it differently, but two of our pulmonologists said, yeah, you're right. I don't know what we call those patients. So anyway, they're probably still going to call them ARDS.
Okay. That'll be interesting to see if this sticks.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I mean, I just thought that was kind of odd.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me it certainly could still be idiopathic.
Yeah.
So. All right. I found this next paper on POW2F3 expressing small cell lung carcinomas interesting. And I just had a case that I think sort of fit what the one of the points these authors are trying to make. So I'll start out by saying there is a ton of data. It's one of those papers that is so data intense, it's like I couldn't read the whole thing. I mean, so I'm giving you a summary. Please feel free to look at all the data that they present, but it was beyond my comprehension. And there's a typo up there. I guess I'll, it should be 2024. So when I'll send you an updated copy, Anya, for posting.
Sounds good.
I think as we're all aware, small cell carcinoma has begun to be classified into four subtypes. POW2F3 is a lineage-defined transcription factor involved in the generation of TUF cells. which of these chemosensory cells distributed along the respiratory tract and elsewhere. Those small cells expressing POW2F3, so SCLC-P here, I don't know which is shorter to say, but I might say small cell P, generally don't express neuroendocrine markers and have low or no expression of TTF1. I think this is an interesting observation. POW2F3 expression has also been identified in large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas and in addition to small cell, as well as pulmonary squamous and adenocarcinoma. So this is not, you know, as we know, no marker is perfect. And I think it's worth being aware of that. No large cohort studies have examined the relationship between the molecular or biologic classification and morphology. So they wanted to just hone in on the large cell neuroendocrine small cell carcinoma spectrum here. So they had 95 cases of small cell and 51 of large cell neuroendocrine. There was a discordance among 118 cases. And so they 18 of those were agreed on by consensus and included in the final analysis. I mean, they could have dumped those and said, you know, we're not going to include those, but they did. They developed a cytomorphologic score from 0 to 12 using a whole lot of parameters that you can see there, including, you know, chromatin pattern, length to width ratio, et cetera. And cases with small cell carcinoma tended to have lower values. So smaller nuclear size, smaller, you know, amounts of cytoplasm and no nucleoli. They also evaluated the degree of tumor stroma and nest formation. So again, trying to get at what we would see in large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. They also evaluated comedonecrosis, bronchial intraepithelial involvement, and background lung fibrosis. So again, there's a lot of data here. Feel free to go and take a look. They used 18 different antibodies, including the ones that are typically used for subcategorizing small cell, Synapto, Chromo, CD56, and all the other ones that you can see there. They evaluated over 2,000 sections. 57% of the cases were reviewed by whole slide imaging and the remaining by spiral arrays. And, you know, I just did not take the time to look that up. So again, there are only so many hours in the day. They also used RB1 expression as retained or lost, PD-L1 by the TPS score, and the rest of them were done using an H score from 0 to 300. Additional details can be found in the paper and in prior studies. So what did they find? I'll show you the images in just a second. So the POW2F3 dominant small cells and large cells showed overlapping cytomorphology, while the non-POW2F3 dominant small cells and large cells sort of seem to be at the more standard ends of the spectrum. POW2F3 dominant, and then here they lumped them then, the ones that sort of fell in between and called them neuroendocrine carcinomas, exhibited significantly more abundant tumor stroma, more prominent nest formation, more frequent bronchial epithelial involvement, less frequent background fibrosis than the non-POW2F3 neuroendocrine carcinomas. This subgroup was also characterized, as might be expected, lower expression of TTF1, CEA neuroendocrine markers, and higher expression of BCL2, CMYC, and c-KIT. The POW2F3 dominant neuroendocrine carcinomas had significantly better prognosis, which also was interesting, than the non-POW2F3 dominant carcinomas, and also had a higher smoking index. So they, you know, their conclusion really was that these POW2F3 dominant neuroendocrine carcinomas form a unique subpopulation exhibiting intermediate cytomorphologic features. And it really made me wonder if we were back to having an intermediate category of small cell lung carcinoma. So here's their figure three. This is the standard small cell. Sorry, this is A here is the standard small cell. And this was their small cell that was POW2F3 positive, the large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas that were POW2F3, and then this was the standard large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So, really you want to compare this PE to that PE, and, they're not that much different, right? Which I think is kind of their point. And maybe we're back to having an intermediate small cell. I did have a case recently where we really struggled with that. I sent our, sent the slides up to Rochester to have the POW2F3 done. And I think that's one of maybe three cases that I've used it on lately to try to tease out what was going on. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting article and maybe worth tucking away for challenging cases. Comments?
Very interesting. Thanks for presenting that. I had two comments, question. One is, I'm wondering if the POW2F3 large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, maybe what they recently previously described as large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma with the small cell kind of mutation or molecular changes. And the other question was, these 18 cases they needed a consensus on, instead of putting them together with all other cases, it would be actually nice in the end to see where they fall into which category.
Right. I thought that was a little odd, and I like your thought. It would have been nicer if they left those separated and then see where they fall out. So Anya, to be fair, it's possible that they mentioned that somewhere in the paper. I could not read every line of this paper. So
yeah, I completely understand.
You get it, So I don't want to be unfair to the office if they actually did something like that, but it certainly didn't stand out when I was reading it. So
in our consult service, awful lot of cases that were called large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, we end up calling small cell. I mean, at least for me. Because I'm kind of old school, like Henry maybe. So I grew up with intermediate small cell carcinoma, and I know that Jeff and you were against large cell, at least I know that Jeff was totally against some type of large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, although I admit there's no way we can call small cell carcinoma, look, so the category exists, I suppose, So to in short, I think many of the cases that, they call large neuroendocrine carcinoma, maybe in fact that used to be called, intermediate small cell carcinoma. And that kind of fits the TCGA data, I suppose, because large neuroendocrine carcinoma, some of them really side with adenocarcinoma. Oh, actually, sorry, it was a large cell. Never mind that part. Yeah. So I suppose, that's something we are going back, to the era of intermediate small cell.
Perhaps. Yeah.
Jeff still doesn't like large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. I'll speak for him since he's not here. And I will tell you, if I put on my Jeff hat and looked at that picture of the POW2F3 positive large cell, he would say, why didn't they call that small cell?
Yeah,
he's not here, but I can imagine him saying that.
Yeah.
May I ask you guys this? Who in which institution do the clinicians treat them separately, and in which do they treat them the same? Because for us, it's always my understanding they treat the large cells and the small cells the same. So we don't really have to stress out about that. But mm-hmm. It seems like in other institutions, they don't. They treat them differently.
Here at Michigan, it's the same as you. Large cell and small cell are treated the same.
Okay.
I think that's true in Calgary as well.
I would have to say I'm not positive. Yasmin, do you know?
No, I'm not sure off the top of my head. I think they treat them the same, but I don't want to speak out of turn if that's not the case, but I believe they do.
I mean, I think they would probably treat them the same if they're metastatic. If you've got a solitary nodule that you call large cell, they're maybe more likely to go in and take that out than if you call it small cell, right? So maybe there's a difference there, but I'd have to ask our oncologist. Maybe I'll send Vinny a note and just find out what what they're doing.
Is anyone using the POW2 antibody?
Yeah, we are. I mean,
Okay.
Rochester has it, so we send it up.
Yeah, and actually, it's totally true. It's not specific for small cell carcinoma or any neuroendocrine carcinoma. For instance, the thymic carcinomas express it too, at least in a quite large subset.
I think
It's
it's helpful if you really think it's small cell and you can't get neuroendocrine markers to study. Although but my routine is not to order neuroendocrine markers anyway on small cell. So I don't typically order it. But if on a consult it comes with them and then it's negative, and then it's kind of helpful if you've got the antibody to do it. So I've used it a couple of times in that setting.
Yes, that's how I use it too. And usually they are also TTF1 negative.
Right,
That.
right.
Yeah. It's
Henry,
kind of like the new better CD56. Sorry.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I just had a question. What do you do then for your immuno workup, Henry? Like on your in-house for, say, if you're not doing neuroendocrine markers?
yeah, so if I've got a, I'll do a TTF, a MIB, and a keratin. Full
Thanks.
stop. I mean, I don't, and I would never use CD56, but I know Jeff wouldn't either unless he's turned a corner.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. All right, just quickly, there's another paper on treatment of systemic sclerosis, and in fact, their recommendations, are not for pirfenidone. They think they ought to do further research on pirfenidone in that setting. There's kind of a nice paper here by the Italian group looking at mixed pulmonary carcinoma and carcinoids. They seem to have the same driver mutations, which is kind of interesting. So they're probably not collision tumors, but they're rising out of the, the same mutation. Let's see. More occupation. We sometimes get asked whether exposure to benzene or other things is associated with pulmonary fibrosis. Here's one about lung cancer risk. And this is a European and Canadian study that probably benzene exposure is bad for you. Maybe not surprising. There's some stuff on thymus. The last thing I wanted to point out was the entire issue of histopathology is devoted to lung pathology. Many of you on the call have contributed. I did not summarize all of these review articles. They're all review articles. So if you need review articles, here's a list of them. Some of them, there's really nothing new here. It's all stuff you all probably know already, and many of you wrote the articles. So just a place to go if you want to use a reference for a handout or a paper or something else. So thank you very much. It's 8 a.m. Have a great day. Thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Thank
Henry.
you.
Next time.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank
Bye.
you.